You're listening to Women Heard, presented by New York Women in Communications. I'm your host, Julie Hochkaiser-Ilkovich. And today I am here with Devika Bulchandani, the global CEO of Ogilvy, and she is a 2022 New York Wiki Matrix Award honoree. Welcome, Devika. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We are thrilled to talk to you today. Congratulations again on your Matrix Award. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. We always like to start these episodes with the same question. We're talking to these amazing women working in the communications industry. And so we always like to start by asking our guests what you think is the biggest challenge facing women in the workplace today. What do you think that is?
You know, if you asked me this question 5 years ago, I'd probably have a different answer. You asked me last year, I'd have a different answer. And right now, I think the biggest asset or the currency that we all have in the world is human energy. Once upon a time, we talked about money, and then we talked about information, and then we talk about time. You know, these were the things that we always said were sort of the currency or the value that we brought to society or to the workplace. But right now, it's human energy. Because our energy is being sapped. Mm-hmm. It's being sapped with the macro sort of, you know, issues that we have in the world, because that's a big drag on our energy. Energy is being sapped at home when it comes to women. Women, whether they're dealing with their parents and, you know, sort of elderly parents, women, whether they're dealing with children, women, whether whatever familial structure they're in, right? The energy is being sapped. Then when we get to the workplace, we know we have to work twice as harder, which takes more energy, right? We know that we have to show up in different ways that takes more energy. So I always say the biggest issue that's facing us is how do we keep that positive sort of energy? And I want to keep the energy in the workplace that brings my womanhood to the workplace, as opposed to, you know, and my humanhood, by the way. I always say it's not just about me, Devika, the woman, but it's me, Devika, right? So it's my womanhood, it's my humanhood. Mm-hmm. And how does that show up where it becomes a radiator for the people around us and not sinks? Because when you talk about energy, there's always two kinds of energy. It's a radiator or a sink. And I think that is the biggest issue facing us today. And I don't know if you've read this latest article that talks about women are just tired right now.
Right?
They're saying women are more tired than, you know, men are. I don't know that because I'm not a man, but I can certainly speak for women to say, I do sense a sense of exhaustion. Mm-hmm. So how we conserve our energy, how do we replenish our energy? And then how do we bring it to the workforce where it becomes a radiator? How do you radiate that positive energy? I think is a big issue.
That's incredible. I mean, we all have a finite amount of energy, and how we can actually conserve, divide it, share it is so, I mean, I feel like this is the next big conversation. How do you treat your own energy? What are some things that you do to maybe make sure you're not spending it in the wrong places and you're able to save some for yourself and give it to places you need to?
You know, I always say I'm an inherent extrovert. I like people. So I draw a lot of energy, which is the good news, from the kind of work we do, because I like being with people. Having said that, I've realized in the last 4 or 5 years that it was a bit of a fallacy for myself. I actually was getting tired of, you know, I come home sometimes and I say, I'm done with my words. I tell my kids that, and they always laugh because it's like at 8 o'clock, it's like my battery switch just goes off. And I've realized how important it is for me not to have the guilt of keeping that switch on and to be able to switch it off so that I can replenish myself. How important it is for me to say no. And, you know, when you talk about these kinds of things, I'm also a big believer in introspection. You can't understand how to treat others if you don't understand how to treat yourself. You can't understand how to run organizations or how to be leaders if you don't know how to lead yourself, right? We have to. So introspection for me is a really, really important sort of leadership value. And by the way, I think it's a feminine value in a lot of ways, right? So I've done a lot of my own introspection to say, I need to be able to say no to things. Mm-hmm. And when I say things, I mean social events, Because in our industry, there is something I could do every single night.
Yep.
Right? How do I draw the line between drawing energy from people? And then there's a really fine line, by the way, where I'm not drawing it anymore, where I'm actually sapping it out of my own system. So I can't give back then to my family, to the workplace. You've caught me at a great time talking about this issue, because anybody who wants to talk about, you know, what is the one thing we need in the world? I'm like, what we need to value more than anything else is human energy, because it is finite and it makes the difference between good and bad. It makes the difference between good and great. And it makes the difference between negative and positive.
Absolutely. No, I'm really, my brain is buzzing because there's obviously many, many, many things that are affecting women in the workplace, but this, I think, is the first time we've talked about this. And I personally feel this. I'm the same as you. Like, I am an extrovert, but oftentimes at like 9 PM, I'm like, okay, no one talked to me. I'm done. I'm done with today. I'm done being a person other than like someone who just sits in my own thoughts.
No, but it took a lot, by the way, to feel comfortable saying that to my children. Right. And also realizing, by the way, that I can't always be conserving my energy with my family. I also need to conserve my energy at work, because work can't just take it from me and my family just be the place I conserve it. So that balance of how do I make sure that I'm giving and conserving in my professional life and my personal life, it takes a lot of introspection, takes a lot of, you know, we always say discipline. And I always say, actually, if you do a lot of introspection, you don't need discipline.
Yeah, it's doing the work. Like, I mean, I hate to use this word work because it's not bad. It's good. No, it's just constantly doing it, making sure you're paying attention to it all. No, this is fantastic. I'm like, I feel like we could do a whole episode just on this, because we have avoided on this podcast. We don't talk about work-life balance anymore. We're like, done. That's done. We talk about balance.
I think, by the way, and I hate talking about that, because we don't need another source of pressure. And work-life balance only adds pressure. I need release.
Yep.
As women, as human beings, we need points of release. And when you say you must achieve work-life pressure, I'm like, you just added more work-life balance. You just added more pressure to my life. And I don't need any more of that.
Totally. Yeah. Oh, I love that. Thinking about it like pressure and release. Yes. I mean, we're just like, it's not work-life balance. And also just the traditional, it's never going to be balance in that way. It's just kind of like your whole life and how can you redistribute. But I'm going to start talking about it like energy versus what we kind of talk about, how we've been talking about it, because it really is redistributing your energy and it's constantly changing, which I think is just what you're saying about making sure you're paying attention to it. I mean, it's so important. Well, I really could talk about this for the full time, but let's talk about you. You've had an incredible career in advertising. You were rising through the ranks at some of the most iconic agencies. You were at McCann, now at Ogilvy. Can you walk us through your journey to get here? So what was your journey from even your first internships, or if you want to start in school, what, you know, some of the fundamental building elements of your career, and walk us through where you are today?
Yeah, I always say I can't talk about my career if I don't talk about my personal motivation or what sort of drove me. I didn't grow up in the US. I grew up in India in a very conservative family where girls just got married and boys went into the family business. At least that was sort of our business structure, our family structure, sorry. And very early on, I remember, which my mother always laughs at now and I laugh at too. Very early on, I remember saying, I want to go to bed tired. I think I was 12 or 13. God knows what I was thinking, because did I get that in spades, right? And I was always motivated as a young girl to be able to do what the boys did. I have two older brothers. So they were allowed to ride bikes. I couldn't ride bikes. And I was like, screw that. I'm going to ride bikes. And I would fall off the bike and I'd get stitches on my face. I have stitches at 8 different places on my face. And the big dilemma there in India was, oh my God, if you have stitches on your face, nobody's going to marry you. Everything was about a girl getting married, right? And it was going to be an arranged marriage. So I jumped off trees. I jumped off roofs. I rode the bike. I did everything the boys did. So much so that one day we had a little joint family setup. I walked into where all my uncles and my dad and everybody was. And I was like, I did it. And they were like, what'd you do? And I said, I can pee standing up. That's how much I wanted sort of that independence that I believed. Because young, you don't realize that. I'm like, what's the difference? The only thing is, you know, my brothers could be standing up if I put back, and I could do anything. So I have an amazing skill, but I realized that, you know, that wasn't the be all and end all. So I came to the US. My family's still in India. Everybody's in India. And I came to the US, you know, because I wanted to be an independent woman. And it was really important for me to have financial independence. I grew up in a business family setup. So there was never sort of that, you know, my mother or my cousins or anybody, any woman I saw never had that independence. And I always, in my head, the root cause of every issue was to do with financial independence. So I was determined. So that's what got me to the US.
And how did how did you come here? Like, was it easy? Was it hard?
I came here. I went to grad school at USC. I went to the Annenberg Communication. I went back to India for 2 years and I worked there. And then I married my husband. We were high school sweethearts and he was graduating. He moved to the US, we got married. I moved to the US. He moved from San Francisco to, he did his undergrad here too, and then got married and I moved to New York. The one thing I swore is I would never do finance and I would never do advertising.
Why?
And guess what I'm doing? I run a P&L in an advertising agency. That's pretty funny and ironic. But I thought I wanted to do something with the UN and I worked on a Ford Foundation thing for a little while. And, you know, I think what I realized is that people who do well in advertising, actually all of us have a little bit of an, you know, impatience and we like to see results and the whole sort of the nonprofit world, nothing ever happens. So my brief stint with that world, I realized I needed to do something that was different. I get married, I land up in the US and I work on 57th between 8th and 9th, I worked at a copy center and I got $7 an hour. And I swear to God, I thought I'd hit the jackpot.
Wow.
I made photocopies. Remember those things called photocopies? And
yes,
I helped people on Word do their resumes. There was an alum from USC, from the Annenberg School of Communication at an agency called Anderson & Lemke. I called him up. I met with him. First thing I told him is I never want to do advertising. And he said, you don't have to do advertising. How about doing this thing called account planning? And I was like, what is that? And then he explained it to me. And I was like, that sounds good. And he goes, you know, he was like, you're not doing anything. I said, no. What do you mean I'm not doing anything? I'm doing a copy center job. I mean, that was like for a girl. And in college, at USC, I was doing something in the computer center where I earned $1.75. So $7, I really thought it hit the jackpot.
Wow, quite a raise.
So Greg Hahn said to me, he said, why don't you come work here for a little while and see if you like it? So I did my unpaid internship. I actually loved planning. And then they gave me a job and I think it was $16,000 a year. And now I really thought I'd arrived in the big leagues. Because at that point, I'd translate everything into Indian rupees. And it was just really exciting because it was just so much, right? And that was the beginning of my love affair. I absolutely and utterly fell in love with this industry because it is, you know, it's essentially creative problem solving. And I love the fact that it doesn't matter what industry it is. It doesn't matter what country it is. It doesn't matter what target audience it is. But when a group of people from our industry come together, they can pretty much solve any problem in the world. And I just absolutely and utterly fell in love with that notion. And from Anderson and Lemke, I went to McCann and then had an incredible, incredible 26 years there. And pretty much, you know, till 2 years ago, I said my entire immigrant life was spent at McCann. It gave me not just a profession, but a family with friendships. And, you know, I have an American family now, I always say. And I genuinely mean it. My kids have grandparents. I have parent-like objects. My kids have a godmother, like a sister to me. All people I met at McCann. And I just, that was incredible. And then here I am at Ogilvy for the last 2 years, and I pinch myself every day. I think I made this decision in a 3-week period. And I'm glad it was 3 weeks, because any more I might have talked myself out of it. And it was really the motivation during COVID to say, if I die, they'll say she worked at McCann. I was like, how damn boring would that be? I was like, I need another chapter in my life. I'm more interesting than just one chapter. And I'm so glad I pinch myself every day that here I am now at the helm of, you know, the most iconic agency in the whole world, and a footprint and a presence that's unmatched, and a spirit and a soul that is so deep and profound that it's been absolutely incredible. That's my journey in a nutshell.
That is quite a journey, both actually physically in distance and in just all of it. All of it. That is incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And what it is exciting. You were the driving force behind the amazing Fearless Girl statue, which is a bronze statue of a girl standing in front of Wall Street's charging bull. This was game-changing work. And in our research, we saw that you said before that this is one of the things that you were most proud of in your career. Can you tell us about it and how it came to be, and what made it, you know, what resonates with you from that experience?
Yeah, I want to just, again, you know, take you back to, if you look at just symbolically why it was so important to me, and I was like a bull in a china shop. in my own head, in my spirit, in my psyche, that was me, and that was my brothers, and always wanting to be like them. And while they don't represent the bull, I adore them dearly and deeply. It was that sort of same patriarchal thing. Here I was, a little girl who wanted to do every single thing that they did, and was constantly told that I couldn't. But at the same time, you know, I was defiant to say I will do it and I'll find a way. So there was something very deeply personal, and that's that. You know, when I see myself in it, I promise you, every woman sees herself, every young girl sees herself in that. And there's so many men who see the people in their lives, fathers and brothers, and who see themselves, right, their lives in sort of that metaphor there, and the symbolism of that standoff. And so that's sort of the personal bit of why it was so important. And I think it's, when you talk about ideas like this, they touch us as well, right? The people who are doing it, we're also the target audience. They touch us in ways, and that's why people are so passionate in our industry about doing something, because there are personal stories being told. Our own stories are being told through the work that we do. Professionally, it was the timing. It was 2017. Hillary had just lost, and the whole world was up in arms. We were this close. We were this close to finally, you know, sort of cracking that ceiling. And we didn't. And all of us were up in arms to say, you know, it was almost like we had been robbed. So the timing was right in terms of the zeitgeist, which is so important in the work that we do in our industry. And the third is that we had a client with a proposition that was so ridiculously potent, right? Where they were using their proxy rights to put more women on corporate boards. And today it seems like that conversation is happening everywhere. That in 2017, it wasn't. So State Street Global Advisors was so much ahead of the curve. I'd say they sort of ignited that entire conversation and gave it global relevance. So those three things came together. And then of course we had not just the client proposition, but we had the right people on the client side, whether it was Stephen Tisdale and John Brockelman, who, and their CEO at that point, who's still there, but they all looked at the idea and they said, this has to happen. And then it was a matter of taking all the hurdles away, because anytime you want to do something that's never been done before, there's one guarantee, that there are going to be problems that come along the way that have to be solved. And then it was just a matter of, you know, making sure that whenever we got a no, it wasn't a full stop, it was just a semicolon, right? And how do we break through? How do we break through every single barrier and every rejection to make sure that that happened? Because to me, that was a gift to the world, as much as it was a great creative idea that this industry gave birth to.
No, it's incredible. I mean, I was in New York at the time, and I just had it had such an effect on, I think, everyone, a real life impact that you could physically go and see yourself. So incredible. And I can't even imagine the logistics of doing something that just like in New York City.
Yeah, that's over many, many, many drinks. And, you know, I always say my roots don't show right now, but I color my hair more often since it's that.
Like, I can't imagine doing a project 1 millionth smaller than that. I can't, I am sure, but it is such an incredible achievement.
You know, all the challenges and everything, like, it's absolutely worth it. And that's, you know, I talk to clients now a lot to say, if we want to do something that's ambitious and innovative, we can't expect it to be done smoothly. And we have to have the appetite and the stomach for, you know, innovation doesn't happen. And to me, that's a form of innovation. Innovation, new ideas, creativity, all these things don't happen because we have a smooth pathway. There's going to be challenges.
That's just good life advice in general. I would say great career advice, great life advice. I mean, probably the more challenging something is to get done, the more exciting it will be at the end when you get through it. But that's an incredible project.
No great idea ever started and somebody said, oh my God, that's so easy. Nobody ever said that. Oh my God, that's such a fantastic idea. It's so easy.
If it's so easy, maybe it's not such a great idea. That's what we'll take the
Or by the way, if something's easy, that means there's a blueprint to do it. And when there's a blueprint to do something, it means it's been done before. Doesn't mean it's bad. I just mean when we're trying to do things that have never been done before, there is no blueprint. We're inventing it as we go along. And there's two forms of invention in that realm, I always say. One is invent the idea, come up with. The second is we have to be inventive about the pathway, the blueprint to get there constantly because we don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's all just such great advice and so much to think about for me too, coming out of this conversation. You know, I was thinking as we're talking of a couple of unique challenges. One thing I was going to ask you about, and I still am, is about being the first ever woman of color to run a global agency network. In this question, I also want to take into consideration the fact that you came here, you were not born here, you were adjusting to life in America, going through your whole career. And there's so many unique challenges that come with that. So both incredible achievements and amazing that you, your path and where you are today. What advice do you have for those who find themselves as the only woman or the woman of color in the room in professional settings, or even advice for people who, you know, also I think, again, it's a unique perspective who've come here or even maybe were born here, but are first generation. I think that's a unique space to be in. So what's some of your career advice based on your experience?
Coming here as sort of an immigrant, my best advice I can give anybody is for the first 6 or 7 years that I lived here, let me back up. I come from a culture that has a little bit of a superiority complex. Indians feel like, you know, we know it all. We're such a deep historical culture, not know it all as much as there's so much cultural sort of depth in it. And I came here and I didn't make an effort to understand the American culture. And therefore I always felt like an outsider. I didn't have friends. I found it really hard to understand the jokes. And I'm in an industry, by the way, that's all about culture. And yet I didn't make the effort. So my first piece of advice to everybody is before we look at the outside world, always ask yourself, what am I doing? Am I doing what I need to be doing? Because I had an epiphany at one point to say, what am I sitting here and judging the American culture when I've made zero effort to get to know what is my host culture? Nobody forced me to come live here. I actually did make that choice. Right. And sometimes people are forced to be in those situations. So I get it, not ever, but I'm talking about my personal experience here. And, but I didn't choose to understand the American culture. And when I had that epiphany, my world changed. My children now have grandparents who are American. They have a godmother who's American. I have parent-like objects who are American, and I have family. You know, I consider a lot of, because I don't have my family here, the people that I've met here, my family. So my life changed as my own mind opened up. And that's the best piece of advice I can give anybody, to say, always open your mind before you're expecting others to open theirs. Because very often we sit and expect the others to say, come understand me. Mm-hmm. And my personal experience taught me to say, before I ask others to understand me and sit in judgment of them, I had to open my own mind. And this stems from a bigger philosophy I have, which David Ford's heard me talk about a million times, which is we cannot control a lot of things. I say this in the context of business, to say, I don't want to spend too much time talking about everything that's going wrong in the economy. And yes, we need to understand it and what's going wrong in the client organization, because there's lots of things we can't control. But what we can is what we need to be excellent at. The same thing applies for people. I can't control a lot of other things, but I can control how I view the world, how open my own mind is, right? So that's the first piece of advice I give people. And it stems from my own sort of journey and epiphany. So two, you asked me as being the only woman in the room, right? Initially, it was really uncomfortable. And my visual image is I'd walk into a room and I'd always laugh in my head and say there was all these chairs in a conference room, and on all the chairs were blue blazers. Right? So I'm like, wow, there's a uniform for what it takes to be successful, right? It's a blue blazer, apparently. And it was a little awkward, because you'd see these dudes walk in, and I mean, I'm saying dudes, but you know, like senior men walk in,
right?
And be like, you know, be like, hey, Ford, hey, Parker. And I would be, hi, Dev. And one day I just asked them, I'm like, how come you don't say, hey, Bulchandani? But it was, and it was, I mean, of course they can't say, hey, Bulchandani, because nobody can pronounce my name. But they wouldn't even say, hey, Powers, like if somebody was, you know, like, it's so funny, these little codes just change.
Yeah.
So one, you're not wearing a blue blazer. So immediately you're a bit of an outsider. Two, the language, the nuance in which you are addressed changes. So you don't feel like you belong. And it took me a long time to find my own voice there, right? It wasn't like these kinds of things, I don't think happen in a day, they don't happen in a week. It takes a while, it takes a journey, it takes a lot of introspection. But here's my best advice. What I would do, and I still do it, I bite-size things. Because when you think in macro terms, it's just impossible. Mm-hmm. I'm going to change. I don't know how to do it. Or I'm going to become more confident. I don't know how to do it. Like we talk in these really big sort of absolute terms. So I started bite-sizing things. And I would say, I'm going to create a relationship with X. In the next meeting, I'm going to say two things. Not I'm going to speak up. I'm just going to say two things. In the next 3 months, I'm going to do Y. And that really helped me. And it's the best advice I can give anybody, to say, don't think in absolute terms and don't think in grandiose terms. In these kinds of situations, actually think tactically. Mm-hmm. Figure out the one action that you can do tomorrow and just do that one. And I tell my kids this all the time. My son's always like, he's this big grand dreamer, right? And he's the big idea person, which I love. And I'm always, and he's like, oh God, how am I going to do this? How am I going to become successful by the time I'm 30? And I'm like, that's not the goal. The goal is to wake up tomorrow morning and put one foot forward and to make sure that everything that is in your means and your control, you are doing. Then you wake up on Thursday and you do the next foot forward.
I mean, that's the best advice you could give basically anyone, and it's actually actionable. My follow-up was going to be, when you're mapping out and you were looking, when you were looking at your career even, and you were the woman in the room and you're like, okay, here are the things, here are my micro goals. Do you physically map them out in a big way? Do you write them down? Do you just know them?
I'm not a vision boarder. But I'll tell you this one thing I did that changed my life. I was talking to a bunch of women. I'd say it was 6 years ago, maybe. And somebody asked me at that point, do you want to be a CEO? And I swear to God, there was this chills that went down my body because I was fraught with that typical female conflict of, oh my God, I would really love to do it, but oh my God, I can't say it. How arrogant, like, you know, that mental narrative in 5 seconds, a movie is playing out in my head. And then I just came out and I said, yes. And like the weight just fell off my shoulders. And I realized how important it was. And I tell this to everybody to say what you want. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. But just say what you want. And when I publicly acknowledged it, which wasn't my intention, which was never part of my vision. So I'm not a vision boarder, master planner, because that would go against my day-to-day philosophy. Right.
Yeah.
I'm much more of a bite-sized kind of person. But that day changed everything for me. And I know because a lot of those women came up to me. Saying it changed a lot for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were like, we've never heard a woman actually say it. And I'm like, I didn't even like it was like I don't know if I meant to say it. Like it was just. But it changed a lot for me because it's the first time I was honest with myself. And you can't say you're honest with yourself if you're not honest with the world. You know what we think? We flip it always. We always say, I'm being honest with myself, but I'm not going to tell anybody, but I'm going to not say it. So we're actually not being honest. Honesty is open. Honesty comes from within and goes out. Do you know what I mean? And that was a real pivotal moment for me. So while I don't vision board and make grand sort of plans, I'm much more of a bite-sized person. I do say things more. Like, you know, I'm very open about the fact, not tomorrow morning, but I do want to serve on the board. But not tomorrow morning, right?
Right.
And it's all, yes. It's like, it's good to have some sense and to be vocal about it. The challenge in all of this, I'll tell you, is how to be hungry, but how to be really humble and never to forget that what makes us women is, at the end of the day, our intuition, our hearts, and our ability to lead differently. That I take very seriously.
Absolutely. I think it's easy to lose sight of all of that. I think reminding yourself day to day is vital.
Because ambition and hunger can become the excuse for humility and heart. They absolutely can. You know, in the hustle and, well, I'm just hustling and I'm trying to get it done. And, you know, it's like, don't we all need to be hungry? I'm like, yes, but that doesn't mean that we lose. You know, that's what makes us women at the end of the day, is we know how to be tough with our children, but we also know how to be unconditional. And we have got to bring that same spirit into the workplace because the rules were made by men. Whoever said, who came up with this rule? Who came up with the rule? Don't ever show your emotions in the workplace. Who the hell came? A woman would never write those rules. I actually like people when they come into my office and they have a breakdown. I think that's human to be vulnerable, to feel emotion is to be human.
You spend so much of your time at the office and with your coworkers. It's impossible. Remember there was a movement of like, lead like a man for women. And I always have been like, no, lead like a woman.
I tell the men to say, you should lead more like women too. The other thing to me is like, don't weigh your emotions in the work. You know, don't bring Like I tell people at work often, I'll give them a hug and I like to hug people a lot and I'm a hugger. I'm a big hugger and I will text people or say, love you, I love you. And I can't. How can so much positive energy? And then say suddenly, like, I do feel love for people in the world. I genuinely, like, and I'm not this precious person to say, love is only for three people. I don't know who the hell made rules. Never say I love you. Never, love is only for, like, I don't know. All these rules are made by some random, I have no idea why. I just say, and this is the other thing, right? Bring your whole self to work. Bring your whole self to work, but leave 10 things behind. My whole self has my full, my idiosyncrasies, my quirks. So, and I believe bring all of that. Now, by the way, sometimes when you bring all of that, you don't have the best results at work. That's fine too. That's life.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes our emotions do take over and we make mistakes. That's fine too. Apologize. Say, I'm sorry.
I think also, like, actually the last guest, I was talking to her about this, because like after the pandemic, we just, our work and life and everything and home and office just became so like meshed. It's just so together. So it really is impossible. Like often people are working in their house and, you know, it's not like you can say, okay, I have to leave everything behind. You literally cannot. You're like staring at your laundry. So I think it's been an interesting adjustment. And I have seen more of like people in a good way, warming up, being open to that balance we're talking about, okay, you know, don't be scared to say like, I have to go to my kid's little league game or whatever.
I always tell women when they apologize, never apologize for your children. It's so, I just reframed it, right? Because we think we're apologizing because we're holding up the meeting. But really what we're doing is apologizing for our children. Now imagine that child who's five who hears mommy or daddy say, I'm so sorry. What a world where we apologize for our children. So I will stop a meeting and I tell everybody to say, it's okay, we'll go over 3 minutes. Let that kid come on screen. I'll take a minute to talk to them. I actually love kids, so I'm very happy to talk to them. But I never apologize for kids, never.
That's a great way to think. It is a great way to think about it. I mean, women and apologizing also, that's a whole other episode I would love to bring someone on to talk about.
There's two things I'd say. I think the whole world should be more apologetic in a vulnerable way, I mean it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if men were more vulnerable, that would be good. Right? So I think we need a world where more vulnerability is strength. So I have no problem with saying sorry. Like, I think that's okay for people to be able to have that. Again, it's a little less about sorry. It's more about vulnerability, I guess, which I really believe is a very important value and it's a human emotion, and to suppress it is not the right way to lead corporations or lead lives.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And like, I love your values and your leadership. I'm going to come work for you.
Come on over. Come on over. David Ford will tell you all the other side of it later.
Over drinks. That's what's going to happen over drinks there.
No, because I will say one thing, right? To me, all of this is not at the cost of excellence, right? It's not like I say all of this and I'm an easy person to work for. I always say we'll debate everything. There's two things for me that are not up for debate, which is the pursuit of greatness and doing it with goodness.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I talk again a lot about, because I do want us to be the best organization in the world. And when I say the best organization in the world, doesn't just mean winning, in terms of business or awards or things, but also the best organization because it's a good organization, because there are fundamental values there. So that sort of paradox to me, we can resolve. And I think it's a really important one. My daughter is a little bit of a perfectionist. And she said to me when she was about 10 or 12, she had to go to school one day and she had a fever and blah, blah, blah. And then the next day she was like, she would hype herself up and get all anxious. And I said, sweetie, it's okay. Like, you don't have to go to school every single day when you're not well. You don't have to be the best in everything. And she looked at me and she goes, what do you mean I don't have to be the best at everything? If I'm going to be at school 9 or 10 hours a day, mom, I want to be the best at it. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. And that has always stuck with me. And I say this to people at work all the time, to say, I cannot control altogether the hours we work, because we're a service business. We're a professional service. You know, that's just the nature of our business. So I always tell people to say, we know for sure we're going to work really hard. That's the truth. If we're going to work this hard, let's be the best at it.
I love that. Oh my gosh.
What's the point otherwise? Why would I spend 10 hours not loving the people I work with, not being great at, not working at a great company? I'm like, that's a waste of life.
It's an excellent point. It's so true. I mean, we spend so many hours at work.
Yeah.
So many. One thing, you mentioned it before about your career, is you spent a long time at one agency, not necessarily in a job, but at a family of agencies. I want to talk a little bit about that because it's very unique, right? I mean, it's not as common anymore for people to stay at a job for so long or at a company for so long. And I'd love to know, you know, what about the culture there motivated you to stay? Just in terms of thinking about, this is a conversation we're having at my company a lot. It's like company culture, right? We want to have a culture. It's really important, especially if people are remote or hybrid, like really making sure we're all on the same page. So what were some of the motivators that, or, you know, whether it was the culture or something else that had you staying there?
You know, McCann always had an underdog culture, which I loved. And, but it also had this real sort of a familial sort of spirit. It was like hard charging and at the same time, a place where people sort of took care of each other or looked after each other. And I think when you're an immigrant, you start, like I always said, I bled blue, you know, it was in my veins. McCann had gotten into my sort of blood, and it was incredibly good to me. It was incredibly good to me. I learned so much, and I am who I am. Not just in how I've assimilated in this country, because like I said to you, whether, you know, Mina De Sessa, Brian Goodall, they're like grandparents to my kids, parents to me, and Jill Howell, who I met at McCann as well, Dana Mansfield, you know, these people are they became my family, because I didn't have a family here. So McCann was incredibly good to me personally, and professionally, it allowed me to reinvent myself and sort of gave me a platform. And I'd be really remiss, you know, the leaders there in my time, the CEOs, whether it was John Dooner, who totally and utterly believed in me and gave me a platform, and, you know, Harris Diamond, who said he'd promote me into these jobs, and I'd say, I don't understand why I'm doing this. And he said, because you're going to run something one day and you're going to be ready for it. He was gave me more at McCann than anybody, because he would always, and he wasn't easy on me. He was not easy on me. And in private, we'd have all these conversations, and he'd always say to me, he's like, you're going to run something one day, and I owe him everything. He plucked me out of strategy, put me in this role, and then would keep moving me into sort of different roles, and I'd keep having arguments with him, and he'd always say the same thing. He's like, you're going to run something one day, you're going to be my legacy, and I'm so proud to be where I am so that he can be proud. But you're going to be ready for it. I never felt like I had to leave. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I have, you know, be it the people of McCann, be it the clients, the relationships that I developed. There's so many of my friends are still like the clients that I met at, you know, McCann, yeah. who sort of, so I have nothing but incredible love for McCann, the people of McCann, and what it gave me. And then I came to Ogilvy, and I don't even know how to explain it. And sometimes I go, I don't know what it says about me, that in 5 seconds, I felt like I belonged, and I felt like this was my home. And I think I've done a lot of sort of introspection on that, is because the culture of Ogilvy transcends any one person, and the soul of this brand runs so deep, and it stands for everything that I believe in, that I immediately felt at home, felt at home. So I don't know if it makes me a crazy person that I can talk about two cultures with such incredible love and affection. And I will, you know, like 10 years from now, if you ask me, because Ogilvy is my home now, I think I have such gratitude to this industry, such gratitude to these agencies, to take this immigrant who doesn't understand American culture and sort of embrace me. And, you know, I had a exco meeting the other day with the people of my leadership team. And, you know, when I thanked them, one of the things I really thanked them for, and I will even get emotional about it, is feeling so loved here. I genuinely feel loved. And for a leader to feel that is a really powerful thing, because leadership is a very alone, it's a lonely place to be. So when you feel as leaders, and I think women, we need that, right? We need that source of sort of, for me to feel that love gives me wings.
That's so, I'm getting emotional, but I think what's so beautiful about your journey is, I do think oftentimes we, especially as ambitious women, get in our head, like, you got to jump around, you have to go here and there, you can't just, and I think it's a really beautiful story of, they took care of you, you took care of them, you found your support system. And again, as we've been talking about, you spend so much time with people at work that it really, you built these like incredible relationships. I think that's so meaningful.
Yeah, I don't know why we need to jump around so much. I don't. And I have a theory about that. I think in this industry, we jump around a lot because essentially we're all the same, right?
Yeah.
Essentially, yeah. At its core, right? And then the difference really becomes culture. The difference becomes your own need for change. That's an innate human. So I think a lot about, how can I provide that to people at Ogilvy? Because the need for novelty and change is an important human driver. It's our own growth. How do we make sure that we're providing that need without having to have people jump around? I think is an important thing that culture, that companies and cultures need to think about.
That's an incredible thing to think about in leadership, because, right, I mean, even for our own team, right, it's like, where can you grow and add skill? And you're going to leave if it just feels completely stagnant. So I think you can provide that in the organization. I want to make sure to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about your experience as a Matrix winner, because it is, congratulations. It is so, so exciting. What did being a Matrix honoree mean to you professionally, personally, and also if you have like a fun moment from the actual Matrix Awards that you remember that you could share, I would love to talk about that.
So first I'd say is, and I mentioned her before, but Nina DeSessa, who I call she's like a mother-like object to me and my mentor, but really I like to call her my tormentor. She won the Matrix Award. I don't remember when. And I remember, I always looked up to her at McCann, always. And I remember when she won it. And then years later, you know, how Matrix Award winners come back for like the award ceremonies. And one year I was sitting with her and she was there and she stood up, you know, when they have everybody stand up who's been a Matrix honoree before. And I actually remember thinking to myself, oh my God, will I ever be like her? So the first personal thing for me that was like very important, because she's such an important person in my life, to just feel that thing that we had, something that we shared, right? So just to be able to share that with her just I can't even describe it. That was a really, really important bit for me. The second thing is how I heard about it. And one of the people, you know, two of the people actually I admire the most in this industry, and I always joke with Jackie Kelly to say, whenever she texts me or she calls me, I respond to her very often to say, am I coming to work for you? I will do anything for Jackie. I will do anything for Kim Kelleher.
Oh, and, the best.
Yeah, the absolute best. And it was the night that Nina was being on, inducted into the Hall of Fame. And they kept texting me to say, they knew I was introducing Nina, and they kept texting me to say, we need to talk to you before. We need to talk to you before. And what they said to me is, before you go up on that stage to introduce Nina, because we know how much it means to you, how much she means to you, we want to tell you that you're being honored as this year's Matrix. And it was just so, for Jackie and Kim to tell me, in that moment, to me, that was, you know, when you take care to do the little thing, they could have told me anytime. But to tell me in that moment, before I introduced Nina, and the way they told me to say, you go up on that stage, not as someone who's just introducing her, but as the next Matrix honoree, you go, I don't know how to explain it. It was just like, that was so special, right? So having just sort of this watched Matrix honorees, it was the one thing, you know, like in our minds, you always think, will I ever be there? Yeah. And I did think that of the Matrix Awards. I haven't thought that about a lot of other things, but I did. So there was something just incredible. So you take Nina, you take Jackie, you take Kim, and just the web of the women that I just feel are my wings, and Jackie and Kim absolutely are. And then that night, what was really, really, you know, having Rob introduce me, who's my, I don't know, my brother, my, just, I know one thing that he will, I drive him crazy, he'll drive me crazy, but I know one thing that if Rob's around, I'll always be protected. And that is such a powerful emotion and feeling. But when Katie Couric called my mother out by name, my mother who traveled from India, I was like, Mom, my mom's always saying, you never share anything with me. You don't tell me. I don't, you know, you never talk about yourself. I'm like, Mom, what am I going to call you up and say? Like, you know, and I called her up and I said, Mom, I'm going to win this award. You don't know what it means. It doesn't matter, but I want you to be here. She traveled all the way from India. She came here. It was the Matrix Award was on October 26th. It was my father's 7th death anniversary.
Oh, wow.
My father loved his girls more than anything. And then when Katie Couric called my mom out, it was just that, I don't know how to explain it. It was the night, you know, it was the day my father died. It was 7 years of his, and Mom was there and Nina was there. The only person who wasn't there, Kim was there, but Jackie wasn't there. Jackie had to go to ANA or something else. It was very special. And most importantly, I just want to say, to have my kids and my, you know, my husband is my biggest champion, my biggest supporter. My son thinks I walk on water. Just my daughter pays no attention to anything I do. I love having one child who wants to know every little detail. The other one's just saying, Mom, make my egg. Like she's less interested in anything. It was really special. It was really, really special.
That's so beautiful.
I had so many of our incredible clients who came there to support me, and you know, my family from Ogilvy. It was really special. But Katie Couric calling my mom out, but we had to lean over later. I said, Mom, did you hear Katie Couric called your name? She said, Pimmy. And then Nina said to me, she said, I had to explain to your mom who Katie Couric was.
No!
And I'm like, wait. I'm like, Mom, she's like, well, how do you know?
I was just saying, did she know who she is? Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. Unfortunately, we have met our time. I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk to our podcast, for giving your spectacular advice. And I hope I will cross paths with you very soon. I've learned a lot from this conversation.
Thank you so, so much for having me. And I look forward to seeing you somewhere in IRL, as I've learned now.
I will see you in IRL, I guarantee you. Yes. Thank you so much. Take care. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Women Heard, presented by New York Women in Communications. I'm your host, Julie Hochheiser-Ilkovich. Thank you to our incredible producer, Liz Roberts, and the amazing team that works on this podcast, Chelsea Orcutt, Chrisanne Grise, Mandy Carr, Alex Fetter, who wrote our original theme music, and all of the wonderful volunteers on the podcast committee. A special thank you to Donna Jean Plant and everyone at New York Wiki who supports us. For more information about New York Women in Communications, including how to join and all about upcoming events, go to nywiki.org. That's nywici.org. And please take a moment to rate and review our show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.